Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A group of high school students.
Elizabeth and high school students started a project to research a string of unsolved murders. Their research led to the identification of the killer.
Investigators now have an answer to a 34-year-old question.
Once you start getting a few tips or a few leads or a few identifications, then the cold case isn't so cold anymore.
There's a pretty good chance he's still alive.
Everything that the students predicted through their profile turned out to be accurate.
Redhead killer profile, male, Caucasian, 5'9 to 6'2, 180 to 270 pounds, unstable home, absent father and a domineering mother, right-handed, IQ above 100, most likely heterosexual.
There is no profile of this killer except for the ones the students created.
Just because some of these women no longer have people to speak for them does not mean that they deserve to not be spoken for.
What if this guy's still alive? Like, what if he comes after?
Yes.
This is Murder 101, Season 1, Episode 7, Nuisance. I'm Jeff Shane, a television and podcast producer at KT Studios with Stephanie Leidecker, Courtney Armstrong, and Andrew Arno. Mr. Campbell was eager to contact surviving victim Linda to ask her more questions and find out about her interactions with Jerry Johns, the man who was allegedly the Bible Belt Strangler.
How do you pick the case? I mean, how in the world would you come up with?
Well, the reason I was drawn was we were actually working. I was teaching sociology, and we were working with a teacher who was down the hall, and he is the criminal justice teacher. And so we decided to kind of team up and put our classes together, and we were trying to look at the only cold case murder in our county that was unsolved. And so it was a redheaded teenage girl. And she
was it Tina Farmer? Is that the one? Or
it was not. So she's not related. You wouldn't know her name because she's not related.
Oh, that's right. That was, she was. Oh, sorry. What?
It's okay. She wasn't related to any of those cases. What we found out is that most of the police felt they knew who had killed her. It was somebody here locally that she knew. But whenever I was researching, you know, I was just going online and seeing what I could find about it. And because she was young and teenager and it was in the 80s and she had red hair, it started bringing up these things about these redhead murders. And, you know, I was born in 78, so I was growing up here in the 80s. And I don't remember anything about it. So it kind of fascinated me that there were things happening, in East Tennessee, where I grew up, and I had never heard about it. And then when I talked to people about it, they had never heard about it either. And so I guess what drew me to it was, if I haven't heard about it and I live here, and nobody else who lives here has heard about it, how are they ever, I mean, I kept reading the articles, and TBI was like, you know, we hope to get more tips, and you know, we need the community to help us. But if nobody even remembers it, they're not going to get any tips or help. So I think that's why the students wanted to look into it, and I was kind of interested in it, was because we wanted to bring attention to it so they could get some help, so people could call in tips, or they could get some new leads. And actually, that's exactly what happened. That's how Tina Farmer was identified. And I guess that's the reason I was drawn to the case. This may come as a surprise. Jerry Johns was actually colorblind.
Well, that's what I'm saying. None of us had, like, red hair when you'd think of red hair. Mine had a red tint. If you got out in the sun, it looked like, you know, like red highlights or something, but not red, just, you know, strawberry blonde or something. I don't know. Have you seen the pictures of me in the hospital or afterwards?
I have, yes. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I haven't seen it since that day, but I mean, since the trial, I guess. But
yeah, that's what it looked to me. It looked like a dark kind of auburn, you know, and I could tell it had those highlights.
Yeah, I think it was. It was, but it wasn't. I didn't intentionally get red. Is what I'm saying. It just had a red tint to it. So, and it was different color than what I was born with. So, but what he said, what at the very last second, I said, "Are you gonna kill me?" And he said, "Yes." And at first, he said he's really mean, you know, mean, like just real ugly. Just yes. I said, "Why?" He said, "You're a nuisance." And that was it.
It was important to understand how the abduction occurred and what Jerry Johns' behavior was like.
So had he been, I guess when you first met him or throughout the night, was he like charming, or what kind of person was he at first?
He was just nice. And I was in a really, really, really bad mood. And I had this friend who had much looser morals than I did and would do just about anything. And she told me about these guys with these $100 bills and except for me, but you know, so I normally didn't do that. I mean, I don't think I've ever got left with a stranger ever before, but I, you know, there were a couple guys that had paid me money, but never had I just left, you know, with someone like that. And even at the trial, they didn't believe that, but I remember this. One of my neighbors testified that I didn't even know he was going to be there. And they said, well, she's probably slept with him or something. And the judge said, she's a prostitute. She probably slept with all of them, which is far from true. Of course, I'd never slept with him. He was, you know, I mean, not of course. But I guess Johns didn't know that. He just assumed that since I, you know, agreed to meet him and stuff, that's what kind of person I was. And I was no innocent. I mean, just that.
I mean, from everybody I've spoken to, Jerry Johns was at times, I guess, a very likable person. They said he made friends easily. He actually stole a lot of cars because people trusted him, even at like car lots, to take it for a test drive. And then he would just drive off with it. So I was just curious if you had seen him as, you know, a likable, kind of normal, jovial, you know, kind of person at first.
Well, actually, when we went to leave, I don't know what happened to Shannon. We had different cars, and I guess Jerry and his brother had different cars, and I followed Jerry Johns to the hotel, and the entire way there, I was so scared. I wanted to turn off. I was so scared, and I was even praying because I didn't want to go. I wanted to, and then I kept thinking, I've got two halves of these $100 bills, and he'll kill me over them if I don't show up. And that, and a thousand times I started to turn off and not follow him. But if I hadn't had those half $100 bills in my purse, I wouldn't have gone. But he was nice. He never said anything ugly. And when he pulled in and told me he was this, well, he pulled the gun on me and told me to get in my car, and he drove and told me he was a Texas Ranger and that he was looking for drugs. So he looked at my arms and he said, well, you're not a drug user, but you know people, I bet, that does drugs. So we're going to find Shannon. And then eventually he said, I'm going to drop you off here in these woods. And he'd already tied my hands and stuff. And he said, I'm going to leave you here until I find her because I don't want you warning her or whatever, so that she can help him find somebody that's selling drugs. Of course, I had no idea that a Texas Ranger couldn't arrest people here or whatever. I mean, I've never dealt with law before, so I back then, policemen told you to do something, you did it, you know? And that's honestly what I thought until the very last minute, I guess. But he was real nice. I didn't know what I was going to tell you. When he was tying my tying my hands up, I said, oh, that hurts, that's tight. So he loosened it or something to keep from hurting me. Or I said, something was uncomfortable. I'd have to stop and think about it. And whatever he had tied or moved, you know, he loosened or put it in a different way so that I wouldn't be uncomfortable. And then my attorney, I can't even remember, before the big trial, I guess, something happened, and my attorney said I needed to sue him, even though he didn't have any money, would never have any money. And I can't remember right now why, and my attorney's dead also, but he said, you just need to sue him so it'll be down on paper. If he ever does get anything, like a book deal or something, then, you know, you'll get your part. But when I went to sign the papers, it said that he had beaten me all around my face and stuff. I guess because he didn't know about the bruise. I mean, I said bruise, and my eyes were bloodshot for months because of breaking the blood vessels. So I told him, I said, he didn't hit me ever. He was very nice to me, even, you know, made sure I was comfortable while I was being tied up. And he said, well, that's okay, because after you lost consciousness and he drugged you in, put you in the culvert, I'm sure he hit and scratched and hit on the way or something like that. And so I was very, very timid and shy, and I just went ahead and signed it. So that part, he never hit me. He like I said, he wanted to make sure. And he was nice. When we got there, he ordered a pizza. And I've never met him before. Yeah, he was just there. And he gave me $2 half-hundred-dollar bills and Shannon $2 half-hundred-dollar bills. And then he had a whole stack of hundreds and said, there's more, you know. But by the time I got there, and I was so scared, when it was over, I just wanted to leave. I didn't care if I got the other half. In fact, I didn't ask for him. I just wanted out of there. And then he said he'd walk into my car because it's dangerous. And that's when we're outside of the car. Oh, yeah, I know what I was going to tell you about the car. I had the 280ZX, which was it wasn't brand new, but it had louvers and T-tops. I mean, it was nice. It was a sports car. Anyway, he said, what'd you give for this car? And I think it's like $15,000. I don't know. He said, I've got, 57 cars, or however many, 12 cars, 18. I don't know what the number was. And all of mine together don't come to that. It's like he was upset because I paid that much money. I guess he thought what I was doing to earn the money wasn't right. And I used it to buy a car that he couldn't afford or something. I guess it's the way it sounded to me.
So even like when he parked the car and you were walking off the side of the road, you felt like he was just going to leave you there, and you felt like he was still a police officer?
Yeah, he said he was just going to leave me there. And which was a few miles down the road from the place where we were working. And he was going to go back and get Shannon and then come back and get me. But he couldn't have me in the car when he went to get her so that I could, because I'd warn him or something, or I could call. I don't know, there were no cell phones or anything back then, but he was afraid I'd warn her or something. And so that's what he said he was going to do, just leave me there in the off the side of the road and tie me to a tree or something. I don't know, I can't remember exactly, but my hands were tied.
Let's stop here for a break. We'll be back in a moment.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you.
Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Murder 101.
Let me ask you this, like, when did you realize that you were unsafe? You know, at what point did he say something, or did something change that you realized, like, oh, my life's in danger?
Yes, the very minute it happened. He held the gun on me, and he kept saying, if I tried to escape, if I tried to get out of the car and run, that he would shoot me and say that I tried to escape. Which I believed every word of, because he was this policeman that, you know, Texas Ranger. And he was here to find somebody that's selling drugs and arrest them. And he said if I ran, that he'd shoot me in the back. And that he'd say I tried to run. So that's why. And then when we stopped, he was driving slow along the interstate. And I think I might have asked him what he was doing or looking for. And he said, I'm looking for a place where I can leave you until I go back and get your friend Shannon. And then I'll come back and get you. And I still thought, or maybe it was hopeful, that that's what he meant to do. And this first time he sounded mean or ugly was when I said, are you going to kill me? And his whole demeanor, everything changed. He said, yes. And that right then I knew I was there. And I said, why? And he said, you're a nuisance. And that was it. So the very last second was the only time I actually really knew that he was going to do anything to hurt me, I guess.
And so that was after you'd already gotten out of the car and walked over to the side of the road. That's when you asked him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were in the woods, you know, down there. He had, I guess, maybe I had my feet tied or something. So, but whatever it was, he fixed it to where I could walk. When we got out of the car, and then when we got down there, like, it was down a little bank, and he was going to lead me there, and I don't know if he said he was going to put me, I don't know how he said I was going to stay there, probably tied me to a tree or something, I don't know, but he, that's when he took the piece of the t-shirt he ripped into pieces to tie me up, So one of the pieces, maybe it was the ones that was around my leg, I can't remember right now, he started wrapping it around his fingers. That's how that's when I said, are you going to kill me? Because that's when I saw him wrapping that thing around his fingers, and for some reason I knew he was going to strangle me.
That is one thing I would like to ask about, because some of the other victims, even ones who had been dead for many years, I am finding online that there were ligatures made of cloth, you know, clothing, near those bodies. And I feel like that could actually be something that could help them determine if he was involved.
Yes, there was another thing I meant to tell you. I'm interrupting you, but I'll forget if I don't say it. The knot that he tied after he strangled me, the knot he tied was some sort of fancy knot that most people don't know. And what I don't remember what kind, or I have no idea. But every woman, all these women, when these people came from these different states, all these women had the knot that was tied was exactly the same with whatever material was there. Somebody had tied that same exact knot. And that's one of the reasons they put the cases, they thought they might, you know, people came up from Mississippi or were all different states. That's what they were going. But then the judge, the media, God bless them, kept talking about, you know, every single day it was in the paper about the redhead murders, you know. But the judge said, made them stop it, and said they were none, that nobody was allowed to mention or say anything about anything except what happened to me, because if they kept on, he would get off on a technicality because it would taint the jury or something. That's why they all of a sudden weren't worried about, or just quit. You know, it wasn't that they didn't find anything to tie him together. It's just that the judge made him quit. And then when they sentenced him, the judge looked and he said he never, ever wanted him to see the light of day again. And they gave him different sentences. It came to 100 and some years or something, plus 30 days. And they said the 30 days added on there was the what was going to keep him in jail for the rest of his life. And I didn't even have to be at the things where where he goes and tries to get out, you know, parole board or whatever, because he said there's no way they'd ever let him out. So I'd never even have to go there and testify or whatever.
I'm sorry. Can I ask you about the knot? So did he cut the shirt with a knife, or did he rip it up? Like, how did he do that?
He might have cut it with a knife, but he ripped it into, like, 1 or 2 inch strips. He ripped the t-shirt I was wearing. He ripped it into these numerous strips. I don't know if several, could have been 10, could have been, I don't know. I can't remember. And he may have started out cutting them, but I know he ripped them in. I think he just ripped them.
Now, was that in the car, or did he do that at the hotel? When did he do that?
It's in the car when we had gone back to the Ketchewan. And we were in the second parking lot. There was a regular parking lot, and then there was like an overflow parking lot where big rigs could sit, or if they had overflow, you know, too many people. But nobody was there. Ours was the only car. And like I said, he was driving. And he said that we'd gone back there to wait on Shannon. And that's when he tied me up, and he told me to give me what he was going to do and everything. That he did. He ripped it up and used it to tie my hands and feet. And that was when I, you know, I just thought of something that happened that he said, something I hadn't said.
Well, can I ask you about the shirt? So were you wearing it and he made you take it off, or did he have it already? Or
yeah, it was a t-shirt. I was wearing a t-shirt. Yeah, I'm wearing jeans and a t-shirt and a black leather coat. And I'm assuming a bra. I don't know. But he took my t-shirt off. But I'm pretty sure, I must have had a shirt under it or something. Or a bra. And I know I had the black jacket saved my life.
What? How is that?
A corner of that jacket got in between, stuck underneath the strip tied around my neck. And when I woke, got conscious again, I pulled and it came out, and it still wasn't enough room for me to breathe, but it was enough for me to start using my fingers and picking at it. And I thought, sure, he was just watching me to not watch me suffer, but I still kept pulling and pulling, and I felt around, and I was in that culvert, and I thought I was blind for life, and deformed, because my eyes were on my face, you know, like, but it didn't matter, I wanted to live, so I blind climbed up the hill. I could still, you know, I felt it, and I staggered onto the highway, and the truck that stopped almost ran over me, and I had broken my hands apart, I think. I had, at the very top of the hill, I had finally gotten the thing around my neck broke. I was fixing to lose consciousness again. And somehow I got off there. Well, then I had blood started just pouring out of my nose when I got breath. And so here I've got these two strings tied around my hands, dripping blood. And so they thought I was shooting up drugs. The guys in the truck that almost run over me, I staggered out in front of them, covered in blood, and I'd tied up my, you know, they tied up their arm to shoot up. And so they were afraid I was going to die in the truck. So there was an older one and a younger one, and I could hear them saying, "Nope, we can't put her in the truck. She'll die in the truck." And they're in a company truck. And then they had called, I guess, on the CB thing. Sometimes I'd think, oh, God, these are the people that's going to kill me. Because I remember Jerry Johns had this brother, so I didn't know how many of they were, you know. And so I started to take off running or something. Even when the policeman put me in the back of his car to take to the hospital, he was afraid to wait on the ambulance, so I'd die before it got there. So I was screaming, "Don't kill me, don't kill me. He's going to kill my friend," you know. And they brought that out in trial because I'd say he or them, because sometimes I'd be talking about he, Jerry Johnson, was going to kill her, or them, Jerry Johnson, the brother, was going to kill him. So they acted like I was just making stuff up, saying he or them. At the time, I had no idea. I hadn't seen the brother since we'd left, and we all ended up at the hotel, and the brother went to his room. And then I never did see Shannon. But I sent the police the minute. That's all I could talk about at the hospital was, "Go get Shannon, go get Shannon. You know, he's going to kill her, he's going to kill her." And so they went and got her. And
let's stop here for another quick break.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts. or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Murder 101.
You know, I was just sitting here and it just blew me away. You were talking about the corner of the collar of that jacket. Like, it saved your life. That's amazing, you know? That's why you're still here, is that collar of that jacket.
God put that there.
Yeah.
There is no doubt in my mind. And I even went to a psychiatrist and I quit going because he told me that God didn't work that way. Well, God does work that way. He gets your attention. And I knew what I was doing was horrible. And he definitely got my attention, you know.
But, you know, without that, you know, that's what you feel like allowed you to survive that. And, you know, because of that, you were able to, you know, he was able to become arrested. And, like, you saved a lot of people. Just that corner of that collar.
The newspaper and stuff were calling me a hero because they said I acted dead. I played dead. But that's not true. I wanted to die so bad that I just collapsed because I wanted to die. I wanted to hurry and die. I don't know what up. So I just collapsed like I was already dead. But then I lost consciousness. But, well, I must have had a little bit of consciousness because I remember hearing leaves rustling. But I never could figure it out until, I guess, till all was said and done. And I realized that he had drugged me. So I had to take the homicide people back there and show them the culvert. And, of course, there was blood on the culvert. So they knew where, or they knew what had happened. And,
but that's amazing about the corner of that collar. That's just awesome.
Yeah, The news got some of the stuff completely wrong. So, you know, like I said, they weren't redheaded murderers. They were, I thought, well, you should have been around and named it the Bible Belt murders back then, and instead of the media named them the redheaded murders. But
that's something interesting that my students decided was that, I mean, there was, if you look online, and there's a lot of people, victims from late 70s up to the early 90s, and they're all grouped together as what they call these redhead murders. But obviously, they're not all related. Some of them are very different. A woman was taken from her home, you know, a small little boy. So they're not related, obviously. And so the students wanted to separate all these, you know, quote, redhead murders into maybe the people who could be linked to one person who did it, because there's really no way to talk about, you know, the people who are related to one person, because they just lumped all these people together. And so that's why they wanted to give him a name.
And when they had the meeting with all these people from different states, and it wasn't just the Bible Belt, there were states all around, but I think it's mostly east or southern, you know, and southwest and southeast. But but they might have been some from Indiana too. I can't remember, but there were like 52 girls or something that they questioned me about, 52 different women that had been killed. I think seems that, or there was a lot of them, but some of them, like I said, were either prostitutes or homeless. They had no family around. You know, nobody's gonna miss them right away. They had the exact same knot tied. They were found off major interstates. And see, that's what I wish that Larry Johnson was alive, because he'd remember all this stuff. I mean, or somebody. I don't know anybody that's still alive that was back then. But there were so many similarities to the knot. I mean, He didn't take them from their home with their little boy or whatever. Anyway, there's more than the 6 or 11 or whatever. There were more of the women that had the real similarities to what I've been through than what's on that list. And I don't know how I could get a list of those people.
Well, I'll share with you. We have spoken to a TBI agent who was part of this. He had done some investigations, and he told us that we would never know the true number because he said sometimes he would get a call by a coroner and he would travel to another state or another county and they would show him a body and he'd say, "Now we called you because we think this might be related to your case." And so he would look at the body, but then they would have, you know, the coroner's results and it would say, or the autopsy results, and it would say drug overdose. And he would say, "Well, why did you call me on a drug overdose? You know, I'm investigating murders." And they said, "Well, it's obvious she was strangled, but because we found signs that she was using drugs, we didn't want to waste a lot of time on this case, so we just labeled it as an overdose." So he told me that we would never be able to find those because they're not even listed as murders.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll never find them. I'm sure they've never found all the bodies because I wasn't the first one, that's for sure. He knew what he was doing. And,
can I ask you what made you think that he knew what he was doing or he'd done it before?
Well, I didn't think any of that, of course, at first, but everything was worked out so perfectly. You know, he knew where to park my car in the corner of that parking lot, and he knew to walk me to my car, and he stole my car, and they said he had numerous other, he had a briefcase with him that had dozens of, stolen titles, I guess, to cars. I guess he had lost his stolen cars. And, they took me down to the culvert where evidently he had done a lot of women that way. And
yeah. So like his story, like him being a police officer, you feel like he had done that before and he was very convincing? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I believed every word of it. He looked at my arms to see if I'd been, had any marks on them. And, where would you look for drugs more than, you know, a place like that? That'd be, you know, and, you know, I thought he was a Texas Ranger. I mean, I honestly did. He acted like it. And I don't know when I saw his gun. It seemed like I saw it, and he said this because he was a Texas Ranger. I mean, of course, like I said, I didn't know Texas Rangers weren't allowed to practice anywhere in Texas, you know.
Can I ask you a question about the knots? Did he seem like he had tied those knots before? Did he have any trouble? Did he know exactly what he was doing?
No, I had no idea. I bet that's...
I mean about him. When he was tying the knots in your shirt and things, did it seem like he knew exactly what he was doing, like he'd practiced or he'd done that before?
When he tore up my shirt, he did, because I thought, who would have even thought to take my T-shirt off and rip it up to tie me up with? That just dumbfounded me, because... who would have thought that? And he didn't tie any knots. Well, I don't know if he did or not. He had to have tied some sort of knot so I wouldn't get loose. But at the time, it didn't. I didn't know any difference. A knot was a knot. I mean, they said it was some sort of special knot. That you learn, I don't know, in the service or something. Or.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have some pictures of that. They actually preserve those in the case file in Nashville. So I have pictures of those that I've looked at, and I can't say that they're complicated. I don't know enough about knots, but there's a lot of knots like tied on top of knots with that. And so I'm trying to find somebody who's an expert with knots to say, you know, is there a certain name to that type of knot, or is there a place where you learn it? So we're trying to look into that.
Yeah, I know, that's why I wish that I had. That's the first, they told me that. Of course, I didn't know anything about knots, but they're the ones that told me. And they said it was like, okay, if you're standing behind me and you strangle someone, and I can't remember, say it's on the left side. They were even in the same position, I guess, on the women. You know, like when you finish doing your dishes, you always put your sponge a certain place, you know. I mean, I guess is how I thought about it, whatever. Just, and there, I can't remember all the other similarities, but there were other similarities I mean, most of the women, I think, were about my height, and they weren't family people. You know, they didn't. Nobody would be looking for them for a while. And
well, just going back to something that you said, that they showed you lots of different pictures of women. And, I mean, did you feel like he had it in him to kill a lot of other people?
Absolutely. I knew without a doubt he killed other people. But, I mean, there was when the minute he said yes, and then he just, you know, when he took me down the hill, he pulled the gun on me. It's like when we were walking down or while we were there is when he pulled the gun on me. And I screamed. And he told me to shut up or he'd shoot me. And I shut up. To this day, I'm not sure how, but I did. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that he killed lots of women. Now, well, like I said, we'll never know how many. And I hope for their family's sake we can find some of them and give them, well, closure, what, you know, whatever. But I know he's killed. In fact, all these years, I wanted to go and look at him and say, why? You know, but I never could.
More on that next time. Murder 101 is executive produced by Stephanie Lidecker, Alex Campbell, Courtney Armstrong, Andrew Arno, and me, Jeff Shane. Additional producing by Connor Powell and Gabriel Castillo.
Editing by Jeff Twa and Davey Cooperwasser.
Music by Vanacore Music. Murder 101 is a production of iHeartRadio and KT Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.